American Sociological Association for the best article in law in 2014. His work explores how institutional structures shape penal change over time. And as I mentioned last time, that he's going to be speaking about the world's largest jailer examining the causes and consequences of mass incarcerations in the United States. So I'm sure there's going to be a lot of questions, so listen up. Thank you.
Okay, can everyone hear me okay?
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate the chance to come and speak to you about an issue that's central to my research, but also central to my own political interests, and that is the growing levels of inequality and disadvantage that disproportionately affect, in particular, large groups of minorities in the United States, but increasingly just large numbers of people who are poor and dispossessed. Incarceration has become a standard part of the life force for many people in this country, and so for me, it's one of the most pressing social issues that we have today. Today I'll be talking to you, and I'm using some of the terminology we use in academia to discuss it. We call it mass incarceration. When we talk about mass incarceration, the clicker is not working. No problem. What I mean by mass incarceration is essentially the widespread use of prisons to essentially warehouse offenders. This is a relatively recent development in American history. Generally, throughout American history and in many other nations, the use of the prison was a kind of a response of last resort to social deviance, to criminal offending. And it was a place often considered a relatively hopeless place. People realize that prisons don't necessarily do a lot to make people better. They don't do a lot to improve public safety. And they end up doing a lot of bad things and problematic things for those people who go to prison. So part of what's happened here is that prisons and the use of prisons in the United States have become so commonplace that they've created new and unsustainable problems. Essentially, prisons have become so expensive, and the correctional structures and the carceral state that surround them have become so expensive that they're less politically palatable than once they were. And this has created new problems and dilemmas that have really opened up a window of opportunity for change. There are new organizations called Right on Crime, where some former advocates for prisons and law enforcement policies that target and incarcerate people for long periods of time have started to crack the window open a little bit for a little bit of bipartisan compromise in places like South Carolina and Texas. So states are beginning to reconsider this thing. Certainly there's been some of that at the federal level. Well, as this chart shows you here, small letters, but the effects the same. The blue line here is the level of incarceration per 100,000, and that's what we use to control for population change, to just kind of get a sense of the degree to which a polity incarcerates people. The blue line here shows you from 1925 here to 2006, which is by the time the prison population really reached its peak. This shows you the changes in incarceration policy. So you can see here a slight uptick as we in the years leading around the Great Depression, a sharp decline in the years of the Second World War, and then we see a period of relative stability and even declining incarceration rates in the middle of the 20th century before we see the chart go wild with the nation's explosion in the use of imprisonment. Here then we look at the way I've put together some of the other countries to give you a sense as to what we look like compared to countries that we would consider our contemporaries. Countries like Japan, other advanced democratic nations, Canada and Australia, nations that also shared a common law, traditions of English law that we inherited as colonies. And as you can see here, we don't compare very well to our neighboring countries. In fact, none of them come even remotely close to what we do in the United States when it comes to the use of incarceration. So when we think of the United States as a standard bearer of freedom, we're being a bit hypocritical, at least those who are going around trumpeting this, without considering just how many people in this country aren't free at all. Here are the list of countries we actually compare relatively well to. like Russia, Rwanda, who experienced a genocide of over 1 million people in their nation over the course of the last decade and a half. Cuba, a communist nation, and Belarus, and this wouldn't be Georgia and the United States. Georgia and the United States rates are actually higher. This would be Georgia, the former member of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, that continues to have a brutal authoritarian regime that incarcerates people for explicitly political reasons. These are some statistics that get popped around a lot that you might have seen in posters that have become more commonplace by the ACLU. But essentially, the U.S. has about 5% of the world's population and nearly a quarter of the world's prisoners. So this gives you a sense as to where we fit. 60% of the world's nations, and over half, have incarceration rates under 150. Ours are over 700. So this puts us in a class all by itself. You've got to have a lot of money to put so many people in prisons, and that's part of what we do in the United States. Now, it's not the same everywhere. The United States Constitution allocates a lot of power to the states to determine criminal justice policy. There are a few things, educational policy, criminal justice policy, elements of managing certain parts of transportation, that state government has a lot of say in. Each state has its own criminal code. State legislatures have a lot of leeway in the way that they create these things, and state legislatures have to pay for prisons. Remember, jails are locally funded, local institutions that operate at the county and the city or the municipal level, but states are operated by state governments. And we might note here that this period of this explosion of the use of incarceration and many of the places where it happened in the United States happened at the same time that there was a new and renewed emphasis on the need for fiscal conservatism and the cutting of state spending. That simply isn't what happened in the United States. Spending was cut for some things, and for prisons, it grew wildly. So when we look across the U.S. and look at the variation, we have an enormous amount where states like Louisiana have incarceration rates that are wild in comparison to any other country in the world, and only places like Texas and other states generally in the South come close. So Louisiana has an incarceration rate over 1,100, and yet Maine, a state that has the lowest incarceration rate in the U.S., has an incarceration rate of just 148 people in prison per 100,000 residents. So we have a wide degree of variation, and there's regional trends that really characterize this, where southern states have always had higher incarceration rates. And in this last 30 to 40 years, when incarceration really exploded in the United States, those states really went to a different level. Missouri, as it turns out, and I'm originally from Indiana, from a rural area of southern Indiana, so Missouri makes a lot of sense to me in some ways, and in other ways, it's very perplexing. People were like, well, you'll be moving back to the Midwest. Missouri isn't really a Midwestern state. When it comes to incarceration, Missouri has been much more southern than it has been like its Midwestern neighbors. Its incarceration rates look more like Arkansas and Tennessee than it does like Illinois and Iowa. And so Missouri has been an interesting place for me to try to kind of make sense of this. And Missouri now ranks as one of the, generally, the way you cut the numbers, about in the top 10 in the United States, or you might say the bottom 10 in the United States in terms of incarceration. Well, at the national level then, we have a total of over 2.2 million people who are in cages in the U.S. That's a lot of people. That costs a lot of money. That takes a lot of effort. And that means you're insinuating that there's 2.2 million people that are scary enough that they should be separated from us in very, very serious ways, literally, with iron and concrete. When we think of the overall population, about 1.3 million of these prisoners are in state facilities, like the Missouri State Prisons that I was discussing. So when we're talking about legislation that can help change these laws, much of this happens at the state level, where states have a lot of leeway in deciding what sorts of policies are going to establish the kind of penal culture that those states have. About 700,000 people, and jails are hard to measure. Jail populations fluctuate very quickly. It depends on the season. Summer, crime goes up a lot, so there's more people in jails, and then it goes down in the winter when it's too cold to go out and be stupid on the streets. And so these populations fluctuate a lot, but in general, there's about 700,000 people who are in jails in the United States, and again, that's a lot, and jails have their own problematics. I'm generally today speaking about incarceration in terms of state and federal prisons and the people who are really locked away for long periods of time. I could talk about jails for a long time, but jails are a bit of a different animal. Overall, we have about 7 million people on probation and parole. So when you start adding all of these numbers up, these are some big numbers, and this costs a lot of money. So as we talk about educational budgets being slashed in the state of Missouri, when we talk and think a little bit about the overall cost of state institutions, Some cows, hogs get slaughtered, others get fed, right? Education gets slaughtered. The prisons have been getting fed for a long time, and they become quite fat. In Missouri now, we spend about $1.4 billion on corrections and public safety at the state level. And to put that in context, then about $725 million of that goes to the Department of Corrections adult facilities to essentially cage people in prisons for a year or more. And as somebody who works at UMSL, where it just seems we keep getting these streams of bad news, it was good to hear a little bit of like not as bad news today, that things that were horrible just became just bad. That was good news. But to put this in context, the University of Missouri's 2015 allocation from the state was about $440 million. And out of that, UMSL will end up getting about $59 million. So $59 million in UMSL, a place that gets a lot of my students in my classes are African-American, many kids from small rural communities that parents are pretty poor, a lot of first-generation college students. Our state here in Missouri allocates 725 million people to lock a lot of those young people up, and we spend $59 million to keep UMSL, one of the nation's only real urban campuses that has an affordable education that working-class and first-generation kids can go to. We pump a mere $59 million into that, and that's just about 30% of our overall revenue. Pretty frustrating to hear state legislators talk about how they're going to bash the public universities for losing control whenever student protesters got frustrated, because they only chip in 30% of the overall cost of running the place anyway. So I say, well, ultimately, they've been shrinking that for a long time, so ultimately they should get one-third of the say in what goes on at best. So in Missouri, then, if we look at who's in prison and we think about what kind of inmates we have about 32,000 total inmates, of which about 11,500 are black, and that's a lot. When we look at the overall proportion of African Americans in the state, this is a high incarceration rate. But many states have even higher racial disparities in terms of state prison populations. About 19,500 are white. So sometimes it's easy, I think, politically to paint this as a problem of kind of culturally, we tend to, on the politicization of crime, to turn it into it certainly is laced with racial issues. But sometimes it gets brushed under the rug politically when people start to think, well, this is just, you know, we're locking up a certain type of offender who they visualize as an urban street offender. Well, it isn't that simple. There's lots of people all across the demographic platform in the state of Missouri who are going to prison, certainly many disproportionately who are African American. Again, I said the state has the 10th highest. So sometimes people say, well, and this makes good sense, right? If you've got to lock people up, maybe it makes us safer, right? If there are dangerous and scary people out there, I don't want them living next to my wife and daughter either. But of this population of about 32,000, only about half of them are violent criminals. So to put that in context, when you think of who goes into prison, the top five crimes for inmates are people who were distributing drugs, so drug dealers. And this would be nonviolent, so that's their most serious offense. So it would mean people were dealing drugs, but not necessarily somebody who shot somebody while doing it. Robbers, drug possession, second-degree burglary, and then second-degree murder. So the five most serious crimes for which people are incarcerated in the state of Missouri, three of those then are nonviolent crimes. And that constitutes a pretty large proportion. The other thing is these prison populations with the new sentencing structures that emerged with the wars on crimes and on crime and drugs have ended up mandating that states lock people away for long periods of time. So if you're someone who got arrested for dealing drugs and you were particularly crack with the disparity of sentencing for crack versus powder cocaine, these people are locked away for a long time, usually 10 years or more. What that means then is we end up with a lot of inmates that are a lot older. Now, I could put up a chart here that would show you the age crime curve, but I probably don't need to. Surprise, surprise, young people commit more crimes. Younger people do more stupid stuff in their youth. Everybody was there. I know I did. Well, people peak in their offending around the age of 17 and 18, and then the offending gradually declines. By the time you get to 30, 35, most people have come to their senses and stopped doing things likely to get them in a lot of trouble. And that holds even for people who have committed serious crimes in their youth. And yet, with our incarceration policies, with our new legal structures, we put people in prison and keep them there when they're much older. Odds are they're done committing crimes, but we're paying a lot of money to lock those people up. These are the sorts of penalties and punishments that people in my field call life-trashing sentences. put somebody in prison for 10 years. By the time they come out, you've trashed their life. Many of these people are serving those kinds of sentences for nonviolent crimes. Well, the current state of affairs was created by a long political era that we talk about as the war on drugs. People on both sides of the aisle are very guilty in the excesses of the wars on drugs. Republicans, and especially Sunbelt Republicans, people, a certain brand of Republicanism that was born across the southern band of the U.S., some in former Confederate states, but also in states like California and Arizona, kind of led the charge in the law and order policies that led to locking people up. But by the early 1990s, a bunch of Democrats jumped on board, and they were just as much a part of this process as any Republican was by the time we get to the middle of the 1990s. And they went about it in kind of a big government way, started allocating a lot of money to building state prisons. The 1994 Omnibus Crime Bill, which is now making some headlines again as candidate Clinton is answering for some of her husband's policies and policies that she later endorsed or didn't. The 94 bill is something that's very contentious, especially among African Americans, because it was a real important bill in really entrenching mandatory sentencing and in pumping funds into state and local governments to beef up the anti-drug programs that ended up disproportionately incarcerating a lot of African Americans. The federal government essentially incentivized being extremely punitive and building more cages, essentially locked the nation in to a course of mass incarceration. Well, this politics of fear really endured for some time. Some of it was very strategic, a good wedge issue to drive a wedge between working class voters along the lines of race, an age-old tactic in American politics. But whatever the case, this kind of mentality that's associated with war means that you've got to be aggressive, that you've got to be violent, and that it takes extreme measures, and there's got to be sacrifices. This is part of the logic. This was part of the ideological commitment that allowed a lot of lawmakers to claim that the state was inefficient, that the state had to be cut funding, and that taxes had to be reduced, while at the exact same time building huge state facilities, hiring large numbers of people, and in California, a prison guard union has been very effective, not saying bad things about unions. Prison guard union, however, has been very effective, and your average prison guard brings home about $120,000 to $130,000 a year to run the California's prison facilities. Your average faculty member who's at the stage that I'm at, which is a little bit in but not too far, makes $83,000 a year with a PhD. So that gives you a little context as to the political commitment that it took. State spending and efficiency were not the total of the issue. There was this emphasis on fear and the need to put people and keep people in prison. Well, when you talk about wars, people talk about sacrifice. They talk about commitment, and they tend to overlook some of the complexities involved in that war, especially that when you're waging war, you're actually waging war against some of your own people in a democracy, right? This is a place where the people you're caging should have the right to vote. Well, they don't in many states. Only two states allow inmates to vote. Parolees don't get to vote in a lot of states, and probationers. So as we talk about registering young people, and some of those young people would be among the most likely to come out and vote, many of those people have lost the right to vote. In Florida, you have to petition the governor directly to restore the right to vote. One study in my field showed that had people who had lost the right to vote for the rest of their lives, which is how it works in Florida, for the rest of your life, if you're convicted or plead guilty to a felony, had those people been allowed to vote, Gore v. Bush would have never happened because Al Gore and Democrats vote, poorer people vote at much higher levels, much more likely to be convicted of felonies, and skewed that election and many other state senatorial elections in that election and shift the balance of power. So when we think these things may not matter, they do matter. There's millions of people who have been cycled through the prisons. Many of these people are people who are 19 or 20 and agree to plead guilty to a felony drug charge, thinking I won't have to go to prison, I can just spend 6 months in jail and be on parole for a few years, only to realize later they've given up their lifelong right to the franchise, something every American, of course, should enjoy. Otherwise, you're not really living in a democracy. The consequences of this war on drugs have been profound, and many things have happened among them. Among the most shameful is the degree of racial disparity. When we consider the proportion of people, 1 in 9 African-American men is incarcerated between the ages of 18 and 35. The rates of incarceration in the United States for minorities are absolutely shocking. A lot of this is, when we look at the consequences of this war mentality, we had the creation, especially in California, a state I used to live in, of laws that are simply silly when it comes to dealing with crime. Three strikes laws essentially end up putting people away after a third crime, which doesn't even have to be a violent crime, for the rest of their lives. Well, many of these people commit that third strike right about at the age of 30, right when they're about done committing serious crimes. As a criminologist, we can tell you with a lot of confidence, not every one of them, of course, but most of them. And that's when we start putting people in prison for life. And that's when we end up paying a lot of money for health care for inmates. We start doing those sorts of penalties that I called life-trashing penalties. I didn't coin the phrase, but that's what people talk about in the literature. Sadly now, prisons, unlike the military in previous generations or college in the current generation for many other Americans, have become primary socializing institutions. For many kids that grow up in the nation's poorest urban communities, communities that have some of the weakest commitment to education and some of the highest ongoing levels of violence, despite all of this investment in law enforcement, a lot of these children, and they often enter the criminal justice system as children, and they grow up there as adults. And many of these prisons aren't places where people improve the way they behave, as anyone that has any common sense might imagine or has ever watched a documentary or visited a prison should know. But the reality of it is lots of people go to prisons to get far worse. Their health outcomes become worse. Their employment prospects diminish rapidly. And many of these people, especially in states like California and Texas with large and active state prison gangs, have to choose sides. You've got to pick, are you going to be with the white supremacists? Are you going to be with one of the Hispanic gangs? Or are you going to be with one of the black gangs? Or are you going to be one of the people who gets extorted by those gangs in your efforts to survive a prison stay? Well, gangs and prisons and the problems they cause, drug addiction, diminished job prospects, none of these things are good. And something a lot of people don't like to think about is the vast majority of all prisoners leave. The average person who goes to prison is out in 3.5 years. Well, if you think about that, and you think about the kinds of conditions that we stick people in prisons, those are people who are going to be somebody's neighbor, right? Those are going to be people you're going to probably cross when you go to a Cardinal game. You have to think a little bit, and we have to think a little bit more about the needs of those populations and about the consequences prisons have for them. Most people leave. This chart shows you who really suffers from incarceration. And all of these spikes here are, despite the age groups here, as we look across, these are incarceration rates for black men with no high school diploma. So when we talk about how the nation, how incarceration has affected the nation, the disproportionate impact this has had on African-American men cannot be overstated. This has not affected all groups equally. If these rates were at this level for some of the guys in the fraternities at Indiana University that I went to who were selling and doing and dealing drugs as much as any of these guys probably were, then we probably wouldn't have mass incarceration because there'd be a lot of parents up in arms about how kids will be kids, about how drugs are something that young people sometimes experiment with. Instead, in this country, where we are today, the people who don't go to high school, black and white, so this shows here levels of educational attainment, same thing here. So when we talk about some of the issues with drug dealing and we talk about incarceration, a lot of these people are people that never graduated from high school. And those are the people that are by far much more likely to be incarcerated. Many people today then argue that what our prisons have essentially become has become a depository, a place to hold and get rid of people who are uneducated that can't work in a high-tech digital economy where you need skills and things that come with diplomas. Well, as we can see then, the age groups here and the levels of education are fundamental. So then if we look then at some of the consequences that on a national scale as to what's happened here, what happened in the course of our wars on crime and drugs, the rise of mass incarceration. In the U.S., we have two states that have a prison population larger than all of Western Europe, which has 200 million people. Now that's shocking to anybody who can do just some simple math here. 56 million people in those two states, over 200 million in Western Europe, and those two states have more people in cages than all those countries combined. When we look, and this figure here I should probably update, and these things are hard to keep straight, but the latest study, Bruce Western study, would be one that would be among the most conservative estimates of the positive impact that incarceration had on public safety. new studies by the Brennan Center in New York City saying that he's incorrect. This is a Nobel Prize winning economist says it didn't have that big of an impact, and whatever impact prisons had on crime stopped in the early 1980s when we started locking up more lower level offenders. But overall, at best, this had about a 10%, our prison expansion had about a 10% effect on the overall drop in crime that happened in the 1990s. We invested billions of dollars to pay for just 10% over the overall crime drop that began in this country in 1993. So a lot of people aren't aware. Everybody talks about crime is the worst it's ever been. My parents are always telling me this. Like, I have a PhD in this. It's actually not true. Your generation was far worse than the kids today in terms of crime, whether you believe it or not. I don't care, but it's true. That for another time. But overall, then, what's happened between 1993 and 2001, and St. Louis enjoyed this when my friend and colleague Dan Isom was chief of police in the city, crime rates dropped at the sharpest drop that they ever have in the history of the United States. They dropped from 93 to 2001, and today, crime rates in most places, violent crime rates, the stuff we're most worried about, where people get really hurt, are lower than they've been since any time in the 1960s, which is pretty remarkable. Well, we can compare rates in different states in terms of prisons and rates in terms of crimes, and we can estimate the effect that the prisons have on the crime rate. They did almost nothing from the 1980s on to improve public safety. In fact, there's people arguing that they might have been part of what helped sustain higher offending rates over time by having such a negative effect. Now, as a way of comparison, Frank Zimmering, another scholar at Berkeley, he studied Canada, and one interesting thing about criminal offending is that the trends across nations tend to be kind of similar across the United States and Canada and even Germany. It's bizarre. We don't, as criminologists, we don't know why that happens. You'd think they'd be pretty different, even when the economics kind of move one way or the other, but they tend to go about the same way, and as it turns out, Canada had a 75% of the crime drop that we had during the stretch from 1993 to 2001, and they reduced their prison population, and they reduced their rate of officers on the street per 100,000 residents. So we pumped a whole bunch of money into something, and they got almost all the same thing for free. All right. So when people say that prisons must be a part of why the crime rate dropped, they aren't looking at the facts, and these facts couldn't be more definitive. Again, these are conservative estimates for the overall impact they had. It would be easy to justify, easier to justify incarceration if we really truly believe that this did keep us safer. I believe that the chances of my wife being robbed or harmed on the street were dramatically increased. Maybe I could live with higher incarceration rates. But I do believe in science, and I believe in social science, and I believe in these numbers because I've studied them carefully, and there's no evidence that prisons do that, not on the scale that we use them. They certainly matter when you lock up the first small group of people who have severe problems and are most likely to commit crimes, but every time you open that net up and smaller fish at a higher and higher price, you're not making the public safer, especially if we were to consider then where that money could have gone instead, right? Whether we're talking about education, mental health care, whatever. So Tom asked me to mention there was some interest in the private. This isn't my area especially, but I know probably a decent amount about it, I guess. But the privatization of corrections is also something that people talk about. And overall, private prisons don't house a large proportion of the people who are incarcerated. It's only about 8% overall in the nation. But that's no small number when we consider how many people we put in prisons here in the United States. But this commitment to privatization has picked up a little bit of steam of late. And now the correction officials are getting into taking over some of the community rehabilitation centers. They are starting to do probation, private probation in southern states, where essentially, as you read about some of these things that have gone on in the municipal courts in St. Louis County, and we think about the hounding of the poor for their fees, well, now you have private companies who hound these people and threaten their credit and chase them around to get money while they're on probation, and they use that money for profit. So they have a higher degree of motivation to hound what are usually among the poorest people who can't pay to take that money away from them to keep their businesses running for even probation. So we're talking about shoplifters. We're talking about 16-year-old shoplifters and usually the families that have to pay that because 16-year-olds don't have any money. So at the end of the day, then, this trend toward privatization seems to be gaining speed. I personally, as an expert in incarceration, sometimes get unsolicited calls from hedge fund managers, from private equity funds in places like London and New York and San Francisco, asking me about these trends in privatization and asking me how to help explain to them what I think the long-term trends will be in incarceration, so that they can go to the states and dig in and get some of these contracts from the state that they know will be good guaranteed income that they can profit from. Some of those things are things that are kind of hard to swallow. One of the biggest corporations and the most famous, the first one, born in Texas in the 1980s, during the peak of overcrowding in that state before they went on a massive construction project to build their own prisons, is the Corrections Corporation of America. They make some headlines through some of their sex abuse scandals where their guards are molesting juveniles. And also raping, because you can't have consensual sex when you're in a cage, but raping people, female inmates. And the big selling point, of course, is in this era of undermining state funding for various projects, the idea is, of course, that the private sector can be more efficient. The truth is that any study over the long term of the cost of these sorts of prisons shows that in the long run, they show up front they're going to be less, and then the costs escalate over time, and when it's all said and done, they cost more. Part of why they cost more is because they get to hand pick which inmates they're going to incarcerate. Guess who they pick? The people that are the healthiest, the people that are the youngest and easiest to manage, and the lowest level offenders. Essentially, people who probably shouldn't even be in prison, right? So they handpick the easiest inmates, not the ones with mental health problems, not the ones with serious health problems, not the ones that have committed violent crimes. Take those out of the state prison system, which essentially hardens your state prison system by taking out what might have been moderating inmates, people who wouldn't be looking to do violence at the same level or participate in it. And so you have a hardening of your state prison population, and you have this creaming effect from private prisons, where they then pick these inmates and make a lot of money from the states. They make their revenue at CCA, I think I looked it up before, it was like $1.2 billion a year. Well, where's that $1.2 billion coming from? Our wallets. That's where it's coming from, plain and simple. The inmates don't pay for a lot of the stuff they can't. They're being incarcerated. So in the long run, the states pay. And this creaming has a lot of negative consequences that roll downhill. But part of what's happened is with this explosion of private equity, one thing that's of interest, and I've heard some discussion of money during some of the cheery discussion of the state and national legislative scene today, about the lobbying effort. So one thing is people like me, professors, we also don't make a lot of money, and I'm a critic of incarceration, and if I had the resources, I would like to go lobby some people and pump some money into campaigns, and I can. CCA can. And so CCA spends a lot of money in state elections with pivotal lawmakers pumping money into campaigns, and they do it on the sly. They don't publicize these things, but they buy a lot of influence in state capitals across the country, and they've been very effective. Not a lot of people track the contracts that are a part of state correctional departments. It's just not something that makes the news. It's something that most people don't get directly affected by, that they can visibly see. They actually do, of course, because it undermines institutions they might rely on. But ultimately now we have a corporation, a multi-billion dollar corporation, that's essentially able to fight pretty much unopposed in their lobbying campaigns, right? Usually this stuff, big money faces off against other big money. Well, here, big money versus some of the nation's poorest, least influential, most marginalized groups. Not much of a fight. Hasn't been much of a fight. Remains not much of a political fight. In the end, building prisons and putting people in cages is a political decision. And like a lot of the rest of our politics, is operated that way. Well, here's what we end up with when we do these things. We can see here, this is a website from a company, a private equity firm owns this company named Securitas, and they have JPEG. And as you can see here, here's what it looks like when you and your child sit down to talk to your husband who's in prison. You know, you're white, middle class, got a couple of nice shirts on, you're all smiling because we're going to chat with daddy, we're going to video chat with daddy in prison. That's not what it really looks like, of course. And so here is a company that you can, and remember who we're usually talking about, you can download an app on your phone and JPay, or you can get on your computer and JPay for a very large fee will allow you to video chat with your brother, with your cousin, or with your husband, or your father through their system that the state, they have signed a very lucrative contract to charge, and of course the state doesn't pay, This goes, the charge for this goes directly to the families, again, families who are among the poorest people in the state of Missouri and across the nation, they pay. Well, that's not the look on people's faces when they see their daddy in prison. Here's the charge fee. So to put some numbers to all this, obviously we're talking about a lot of people don't have a lot of money to send to an inmate, to a loved one who might be incarcerated, but you can do through the internet, you can deposit money into their commissary account very easily. You can go online and do it. And all you get charged is about a 25% fee on depositing $20 into your loved one's account. Now, one can imagine the impossible psychological toll something like this would take on, say, a grandmother or a mother of someone who's incarcerated. You know that you can have your nephew go on the computer and deposit this money in the account of someone who's incarcerated, that's a family member and a loved one, and do it very easily, right? It'd be hard to resist. This has kind of the ease of a credit card. And yet, the exorbitant fees then, it drops to 16% when you go to 50 bucks, and you got to imagine a lot of these deposits are going to be relatively low level. This is the new way that private equity funds have set these up across 2,000 different penal institutions in the United States, and they're reaping in money, not from us taxpayers, but from the poor families whose children are incarcerated. So this then, and fathers and husbands and boyfriends are incarcerated. This is a very slick, under-the-radar way of just exacting a huge sum of money from people who are least capable of paying it. Well, this stuff doesn't make headlines, and it replaces one thing that did make headlines was how much this same company was charging for telephone calls. So telephone calls was something that finally the FCC intervened. States were getting big kickbacks to lower their into their coffers to help pay for all these prisons. And in return, inmates and their families were paying huge amounts of money in an era when phone calls, you know, used to, your phone bill, I was kidding, mad, right? It was like 25 cents. My dad would be like, get off there, your aunt. You talked with her enough, right? Well, that doesn't happen anymore because phone calls are very cheap, not in prison. Phone calls were extremely expensive, and the FCC finally intervened and required that there be a certain standard. These companies, corporations, private equity firms took a big hit. A lot of their profit margins shrunk. Well, these people are smart, they're rich, they're tech savvy. Always ahead of government by a step or two, they came up with this system. It essentially replaces and improves on their ability to sap money out of the nation's poorest members. It's not all bad news, seems like it, and it's a dreary subject, and I talk about it a lot, and it's hard to stay optimistic at times, but this is a period when there are some voices that are being raised about some of these problems, and one way to begin to think about that is that you've got to have an alternative. It isn't easy to just say you're against prisons without saying that you have something that you're for. You have to have some sort of a plan as to what would be better, what would make us safe. Well, part of doing that then is to talk about things, and I would say for us as criminologists, there should be more of a voice from people who actually know something about criminal offense patterns and what incarceration and corrections do to people who are incarcerated. We don't incorporate that kind of knowledge in the state lawmaking process. One wonders what knowledge ever does get incorporated in the state level process. And I say that as a social scientist who reads from the 1980s as state lawmakers read reports that said this was a horrible idea and kept doing it over and over and over. Anyway, not just in jest, but in fact, this is where I'm coming from. Well, part of it is we should keep people out of prison. Once they go, they have a hard time finding work. A lot of the people that get sent there come from already very disadvantaged conditions. People, like I said, who didn't graduate from high school. When you put those people in prison, you literally multiply and amplify the disadvantages that probably had them go in that direction in the first place. Doesn't help. That doesn't mean, of course, that you can't, that you know, you shouldn't and can't respond to serious violent offenders with very, very custodial approaches. Most criminologists understand that's got to be a part of dealing with offending. The reality of it is we use it far too often for far too many people for whom it is very ineffective and even makes things a lot worse. Part of this then means that you don't talk about war. You have to talk about dealing with crime for what it is. It's a social problem. It's a social problem that's deeply linked to a lot of other social problems. And this used to be common knowledge. In the 1920s, when sociology was born in the University of Chicago, essentially in its modern form, people made, this was explicit. Everyone understood this was the only way to talk about crime. Well, things changed in the 1970s, in the late 1960s, and we started talking about wars against internal members of our society, against our own citizens, against other Americans. Waging war against your fellow citizens isn't a good thing. You can't wage war on drugs. You wage war on drug offenders. You wage war on the families of drug offenders, and you're waging war against other Americans. It's not a happy scene, and it obviously doesn't play out in happy ways. If this war had been waged on crime, and if it had ever been a good idea, and all the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been spent on it, then we would know then that drugs would be hard to find, and that violence in the United States would hopefully be rare. Maybe it'd be a war that we had won, and one could say, well, prisons stink, and it stinks to put so many people in prison, but that's what it took to clean up America's cities. But we all know that you can go to neighborhoods. I live in Soulard in the city. And you can go just down the street, and I assure you that the war on crime was not very effective in increasing the living standards and lowering the violence that's a part of certain parts of the city. It didn't happen. It didn't work. Those places remain very scary places, and there's nothing wrong with saying that you think you're scared of those places. The people who live there are scared of going out at night. They don't like it either. These communities didn't get fixed. Neighborhoods didn't get improved by the war on crime. Instead, lots of young men just got taken away. They go back to those communities. They're hard to employ. They have to go back and live with sisters, with grandmothers, with their moms, and they become a burden they don't want to be, and a burden that is difficult to manage for everyone in those communities. So this is a real problem, and it hasn't improved conditions in those communities, and it remains a stubborn and intractable problem that's rooted in deep socioeconomic disadvantage. Another alternative is that The approach has been to just get out the club and attack aggressively, waging war with the criminal justice system. Well, the only way that you're going to really affect crime is going to be to also think about how other institutions can have an impact. Education, few things can do more, because you have kids literally in a different type of cage. School was a cage. They wouldn't let me just leave when I wanted to. Me and my girlfriend were not allowed to just walk off and go do what we wanted. We were forced to stay in the school. They had control of where we were, and they taught us some things, and they at least knew where we were at and what we were doing, and helped train us to do things like hopefully go to college, but at least not to end up in prison. Education should be a part of this, and so should public health networks. A lot of these things are rooted to deep problems in poor neighborhoods that transcend just crime. So working with other institutions seems imperative, and some places are doing this, like I mentioned in the beginning. One approach to this has been legalizing marijuana, and that whatever you think of marijuana, whether it's good or bad, a lot of people have come to the realization that locking people up for a long time for it just isn't a very good approach, and that it's generally not affected the people. White people smoke more weed than do African Americans, as it turns out, when you do surveys of young people. But black people are much more likely to go to prison. Hispanic people are much more likely to go to prison for dealing low-level drugs like marijuana. Well, legalizing those drugs is one step, one thing that states have done that can reduce the amount of people going to prison. Another is the federal level. So federal government has a different operation in all this, and one thing is that they've called the dogs off in terms of aggressively policing and incarcerating low-level federal drug offenders. People who once would have been caught in the federal net, those federal prosecutors have been told essentially to focus on other crimes and let those offenders be managed in state courts. Federal, when you're treated as a federal offender, 98% of all people just plead guilty, because when the feds pick your case up, you're in trouble. And then lastly, many states have done really good things, and those states are diverse. California did it, but they didn't do it because it's a bunch of liberals who are all kind-hearted and wanted to make the world a better place. Jerry Brown was dragged kicking and screaming through the U.S. Supreme Court and forced to release 40,000 inmates because they were letting people die because they couldn't get their medicine and die of things like hepatitis in their prisons whenever those things could have been prevented. But other states like Texas have started to do these things. Texas has started diverting low-level drug offenders. And states like New York and New Jersey have decreased their prison populations by about 30%, which is a big number in social science, in just 15 years. So these are major reductions that have happened. It's possible. There's models. There are people out there working toward it. But unfortunately, I have to end on a bit of a sad note. When we look at Missouri's future, Missouri isn't one of those states that has reduced the prison population. And as the legislative report that we all listened to talked about, there aren't a whole lot of progressive measures in terms of criminal justice reform on the bill either. And a lot of this kind of acrimonious partisanship that has come to characterize a lot of state capitals around the country hasn't done much to advance the efforts to reduce incarceration. Some of that momentum has started to wane. I think, as I said already and covered this ground, is, one thing, if you want to make an argument, we have had a surge in serious violent crime here in St. Louis very recently, and this is real. This isn't some sort of tick. There's something going on. Seems to be linked to heroin, but seems to be linked to some other things. And part of the problem here, one might say, is, well, we built all the prisons. We've done it that way for 20 or 30 years, and where has it gotten us? You know, still we have highly segregated, and segregation's highly correlated with levels of violent crime and ultimately with incarceration. Why have these things not worked? Well, we got a lot of examples of things that didn't work in Missouri. You can look at that as a negative thing, or maybe you look at it as a positive thing, as a beginning point to make some arguments about rethinking the approach in the state. Part of doing that then requires people like you, requires organizations and activists to get involved, to get organized, and to channel some of this recent energy and frustration with some of the racial disparities, with aggressive and kind of non-responsive or community-responsive law enforcement. But that requires some sort of organization level. And here in Missouri, we don't have the sorts of organizations that they have in places like New Jersey and New York that are very actively and engagingly forcing state legislators to take a look at these issues. So hopefully moving forward then, you got to start somewhere, and part of that begins with, your very interest in having me come here to begin with and talking about these issues. People like me weren't getting invited to places like this 10, 15 years ago. So this, I think, is a sign of things that are changing across the nation. There's more interest, there's more energy, and I would hope then that this will lead to some sort of real institutional change. And hopefully folks like you will be a part of that. So that's all I have.
Ran a district court probation department, I want to applaud you for the accuracy and clarity of your presentation. Thank you.
Two questions, one specific, one more general. The specific one, are there any nations that have a higher incarceration rate than ours? And the more general one, can you speak at all about the incidents and consequences of solitary confinement on inmates?
It takes a lot of money to put as many people in cages as we do, unless you have a really small nation. Now, there might be a couple of little island nations that have populations of a few hundred thousand that have such a ratio of people on plantation-style prisons that they can compare, but no nation's incarceration rate compares to ours. It's partly because we have the resources, we can do it. So that's part of the formula, and we have had the political will to do it. So none that there are none, but sometimes you can define nation, island, states in funny ways. So just a caveat in case anybody quotes me on that one. Secondly, solitary confinement. When we talk about prisons, it's not just that you send people to prisons, right? There's a way one could imagine a world where sending people to prison might be good for them, right? In Germany, if you go to prison, it's often for people who have serious mental health problems. People who are sent there receive treatment throughout much of the day. They wear regular clothes. They come and go from their rooms into other parts of the prison. They receive family visitation. People can come and even stay the night when they're there. And people usually, even for homicide, don't serve more than 6 or 7 years in prison in Germany for first-degree homicide. But in our prisons, the worst level of prison conditions would be solitary confinement. This isn't new, solitary confinement. In the 1830s and 40s, in the first American penitentiaries in the state of Pennsylvania, people were isolated in prisons and prison cells in completely solitary conditions, given a Bible and told to reform themselves, given food, and caged in solitary confinement nonstop for months. Those people went crazy. They pulled off their own skin, they hurt themselves, they pulled out their teeth, they banged their faces against the wall. Well, today in American states, solitary confinement has become something that has been used very frequently as a form of punishment. There's a really good film that PBS Frontline did called Solitary Nation, And they have one special that's on solitary confinement, where Maine has started to phase out solitary confinement. And they let the cameras in, and they show what happens when you put people in solitary confinement. And I had a couple of students that looked like they were going to throw up when they saw how bad things were. People slitting their wrists, blocking doors, not letting the officers in, so that a sufficiently big pool of blood could gather in the room, and then they would wallow around in it. They were literally dragged out of the room covered in blood. This was someone who was serving 3 years for getting in a bar fight. This wasn't some person who came in with mental health problems. This was someone who didn't have them. There is also reform efforts afoot. Maine is one of the states, but so are others. California, Jerry Brown has announced this, but prison guard unions fight it tooth and nail. Correction officers like to be able to have that ultimate hammer put down on inmates to keep control. Part of why they need that is used to, do you know how you were a warden and helped control your inmates? They got good time behavior, and they went up before the parole board, and the correctional officer could say, I'm going to write you a letter, or I'm not. Depends how you act, right? Because there was hope to get out. A lot of hopelessness when you have mandatory sentencing. It means you must serve 85% of that 25-year term. Many inmates give up, become intractable, very difficult to manage because they're probably going to die in prison. They admit that. This was essentially the use of solitary confinement, was essentially using a blunt, horrible instrument to deal with a really bad circumstance that was created by the politics of mass incarceration and the laws that were a genesis from that. So it's changing, but it's still a big part of what's going on out there. Yeah, back to you.
Yes. Very interesting discussion today. My name is Florence Pullman, and I am a retired educator. And when I was working in the school system, I was told by a prison official in Jackson City at the time that when the children take the test scores, achieve the test scores in the fourth grade, they can determine from those test scores, because they get those test scores results, who will go to prison. Now, if they can determine that, then why don't the states then begin to look at some form of rehabilitation for those children, program for those children, before they get to the level where they are going to prison?
Politics.
Yeah.
Plain and simple, politics. Those. So if you ask a criminologist, so your point, we know one really good way to reduce violent crime, but it takes patience and it takes time. So one of the best ways to lower violent crime rates is that we can identify people that are most likely to eventually become offenders the day they're born. These are children who are born to young, unwed mothers, who are born in neighborhoods that have high levels of residential turnover and high levels of violent crime. And there are kids who are born to parents who have very little resources, whose own grandparents, say, for example, weren't married. We can identify a list of variables that can establish people that are high risk. When you send social workers to the homes of those children, two things happen. One is when you get visits, prenatal visits and postnatal visits up to the age of two, the likelihood that that child will become a violent criminal drops dramatically. That was one of the things that they studied. This was a Head Start project that was done in the 1980s. So we've known the things you're talking about for a long time. But something unexpected happened in those studies. They didn't expect this, that the odds of the mothers getting in trouble with the law also declined precipitously, and the odds of the mothers having a higher level of employment, of being employed and having more income, also increased dramatically. The reason? There was someone coming and checking on them, who was helping them kind of feel connected and helping them develop a structured approach to parenting that also improved their overall life outcomes. So those are good things. The problem is those crime rates are only going to decrease well downstream, right? And a lot of people don't have the patience for that. They want to hear, I'm going to come in here, crime's up 14% in St. Louis, I'm going to put more police on the street, I'm going to put more people in prison, I'm going to put them there longer. The problem with that, of course, is how many people who are out on the street selling heroin, carrying guns, and being willing to shoot at people are going to care what the law says. They're not. By the time we get that far downstream, those people aren't going to be influenced by, what's the difference for someone in that stage? 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? It doesn't work in deterring crime. Early intervention is undoubtedly the best way to respond to these things, and it doesn't begin in the fourth grade. It begins at prenatal care, and that's something people don't talk about. For many children, for many criminological studies show very clearly, your propensity to be deviant and break the rules, a lot of that stuff gets pretty much set by age 7. So it's those very early years that kids learn, and it's through good parenting, not just parenting, but good parenting, consistent parenting, that children learn not to break the rules, and the predictions are pretty easy to do, that ultimately we can identify, unfortunately, who is most likely. Yeah.
In Jefferson City, a lot of us follow the money. Right now, a division of Enterprise Holdings, the rental car people, does a lot of the prison and jail commissary business.
Okay.
As I understand it, a Hershey bar you get for 79 cents on sale at Walgreens goes for $3 in prison. When there's that much money to be made, how do you offset the advantage the lobbyists for Enterprise have when they go to a state senator from a rural county and say, hey, look at all this. By controlling people and controlling them in jails, we're making Missouri safer.
That's a good question. First off, I think you start with the cost of the Hershey bar and ask how that can even be possible, right? So part of it is the shopping out of this kind of privatization of state facilities. Prisons are unique spaces. They're a unique social space in that you literally, most people don't see what happens there. And a lot of us like to imagine that the people behind there, or I guess people who don't spend a lot of time thinking critically, that those people deserve to pay $3 for a Hershey bar. But when people can pause and think, and the net's gotten so big, my Uncle Ron went to prison for a little bit. I didn't do this because I have a family member. I did this because I found it shocking that I study this. But ultimately, as the, you know, when we can make it more relatable and say, here's people from your county that are actually going to be paying this money. And today, I just read in the Washington Post, there, you know, when you talk about rural communities, it's something I'm more familiar with from my youth and growing up in such an area. There are 850,000 missing middle-aged white rural Americans because they're dying from drug abuse, they're dying from alcoholism, they're dying from lung cancer, and a lot of this is related to this lack of an expansion of the support for something like expansion of Medicare and Medicaid. I think part of getting those people to understand what's going on in that prison, and with the money, I have no answers to that, and obviously the problems with that are endemic across the board in all of American federalism and politics. But ultimately, the only way that's going to change is that people can link incarceration to other issues of disadvantage that a lot of poor people, black and white, criminal and non-criminal, deal with these things. And you may not be in prison, but you're also not getting the health care you need, and a lot of your lifestyle factors really deaths for lots of people in rural areas. And that's no sign of prosperity, that's for sure.
I hope that this is a good way to wrap it up, too. It seems to me, and I'm at a place where I just really am selective about what I look at on television because we are just so awash in crime-focused programming that whole notion of being at war with ourselves and constantly vigilant is being driven into our heads all the time. What has this, I'm imagining that this has had an effect on people's perception of your program at UMSL. Can you talk a little bit about what your program is about and who's attracted to it and how do you sort that community of people for intention and outcome?
When you say this, do you mean kind of the cultural focus on kind of the obsession with crime?
Well, I imagine that in my head I have created that story, that it's produced a high interest in criminology.
It has, and there are, you know, in Europe they don't have criminology programs. There, I think Greece has two and Italy has four. Criminology here is its own discipline. As it turns out, the University of Missouri St. Louis has the fourth-ranked, nationally ranked criminology department in the United States, which is a very, it's a very unusual thing. It's usually large in places like University of Cincinnati or Michigan State, but we have some really good folks in the department there, and we get a mix of people, but there are more and more of my students, and students of different stripes, students that are from the city, students that are from the county, are increasingly concerned about this. And I think that recent events have raised a level of awareness about fairness. And I make my students read the DOJ report, the Ferguson report, and sit down and ask them, you know, how has this happened? How have municipal courts become this way? And I have them read an academic article on the Ferguson's work plan where, you know, liberal New York City has a set of programs for misdemeanor defendants that makes them jump through so many hoops that essentially, in the end, they're punishing people that never plead guilty or convicted of a crime in ways that are kind of hard to imagine, where people are essentially forced to plead guilty because fighting it You can't really afford to do it. So there is interest. There's interest in reform, and in general, people in my department and some people who are among the very best in the world studied Rick Rosenfeld on policing. We have taken a pretty critical look at the kind of disinformation. I'm constantly unlearning for my students what they come in with from CSI.
Yeah.
CSI is a joke. Like, this is literally, like, Star Trek is more real. And I try to emphasize this to them. These things are, those types of crimes, 60% of all homicides are solved within an hour. Because there were three people who saw who did it, and it was somebody who killed somebody they knew, and everybody knew what happened. This is usually the way that homicide works. These mysterious, well-plotted, well-schemed homicides make news because they're so uncommon. But the obsession with crime stories has been going on since some of the first crappy journalism that ever made New York City back in the 1860s. People were reading, and then her head got cut off. And, this sort of stuff sells. It always has. It has the good guy, bad guy stuff going on. And it's the drama and the gore. It's always going to be.
And where do they go out of your program?
We have people who are master's students who go on to work in law enforcement, who many people are like probation and parole officers, some that go into social work. And our PhD students usually go into academics, but they also go on to work for federal and state institutions that analyze data statistics. And more and more are interested in doing really organizational work of working to change through organizations like the Vera Institute of Justice in New York, the Sentencing Project in Washington, D.C., who are critical of these kind of policies. So we have people that do a variety of things, and you can get an awfully good education in criminal justice for a pretty good price at UNCLE. It's a pretty good, and I'm not just self-promoting, I am. But it's true. I mean, it's
Thank
true.
You.
I sometimes marvel hearing my colleagues talk, sitting there thinking, wow, these students are lucky. A lot of people go fly into where we have annual conferences from all over the world to hear this guy talk, and these folks get to hear it because it's part of their education, and that's not bragging, that's just the facts.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks.